Coming up on Spoiler in Time, the show where we watch things, thanks to Cord Killers, our other show that lets us figure out how to watch things. We're going to talk about Deadwood, Season 2, Episode 2. We're going to talk about the movie Isle of Dogs. I'm going to recap Season 1 of Atlanta because I finally got around to talking to about it. Me, I'm Tom Merritt. He is Brian Brushwood.
Yeah, but most importantly, we have to recap what everybody missed if they did not tune in live to watch the 2018 Summer Movie Draft!
That's right, Brian. First place is you, Team Night Attack.
Well, I mean, not by a lot. We got the very first movie, Pacific Rim Uprising.
I mean, you're ahead by infinity percent.
You know what? Actually,
no
I like this.
No one else has made a dime.
I mean, the Infinite Winners is the current name of our team. Team Night Attack, we ended up with it was a hell of an auction. Night Attack got Pacific Rim, Ready Player One, Blockers, Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom, and Skyscraper. At the time, the consensus was that Night Attack was in a really good position, yet the Movie League Mike missive, I don't know that that's what he calls it, but I like that, Movie League Mike missive, seems to indicate that, who did he pick for number one?
John Trekker.
Oh, yeah, that's right. For Team John Trekker, he wrote, I'm not going to read all of his stuff, but you can check all of his based on over at the
diamondclub.reddit.com.
But hang on, I could no longer see what else I got. DTNS, you got Avengers Infinity War, Breaking In, and Hereditary. Tell It Anyway got Deadpool 2, which is testing even better than the original. Uncle Drew, Ant-Man and the Wasp, and Crazy Rich Asians, which Jenny seemed very, very excited about her lineup. She seemed very pleased.
She very often, having teamed up with Jenny before, I feel like I can say, Jenny always has one movie that she's super excited about that she thinks no one else appreciates. Sometimes she is super right. I'm trying to remember the spy movie that was a comedy
with Melissa McCarthy.
With Melissa McCarthy, yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Something spy or something.
She was really, really up on that movie, and a lot of people weren't, and it did really well. So I don't know. I don't necessarily want to doubt the prognostications of Jenny Josephson.
Team Cord Killers got A Quiet Place, Life of the Party, It's Solo, A Star Wars Story, and Replicas, which I'll tell you what, man, Solo, I feel like all of us undervalued. I think we are so dialed in on the troubles of production that I don't think we valued.
There's new scuttlebutt out of the Solo production. Apparently, Lord Miller got the boot because they were taking too long, not being very efficient. So Ron Howard came in, said, "This is what we're doing. Two or three takes. Let's wrap this thing up." And apparently, a lot of respect on the set. So
yeah.
And also did not change the dialogue. The reshoots that he did supposedly
Revolve
the exact same story, exact same script. I think they got an acting coach in there to make some of that stuff
better. Wow. So. Interesting.
Also, A Quiet Place right now has 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Wow. So keep in mind also, and we posited this theory during the show last Tuesday, but like, think of all the people who didn't like the latest Star Wars movie, The Last Jedi. They're like, "Oh, I like the old Star Wars." Well, guess what? That's exactly what you're going to get here. And I feel like some number of people are going to go nuts for the nostalgia bomb.
Yeah, you may be right. I'll tell you what's going to happen. Night Attack has Ready Player One and Blockers. So you are going to be in first place until April 27th when Avengers Infinity War comes out.
That's right.
You may still be in first place on May 4th, but by May 4th, for sure, or at least by May 11th, I will be in first place. And I will stay in first place till we find out otherwise. Is it going to be Solo? Is it going to be Jurassic World? That'd be my guess.
Well,
that pushes you back up in front. But, you know, my problem is I went all in on Avengers Infinity War because usually I don't go in on the big movie. And by my calculations, it was being undervalued. So I'm like, I'm going to take it. Maybe people are going to wait to spend their money too late. That would work if I could spend my other $15 efficiently, which I wasn't able to do. And that's the beauty of the draft dynamics, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, you're not playing the movies. You're playing each other. To round out the horn, John Trekker has Rampage, I Feel Pretty, Book Club, Incredibles 2. That's a big one. The First Purge, Mission Impossible, Fallout, really good chance of running away with it on that one. And Team Chips, bitch, has Truth or Dare, Super Troopers 2, Overboard, Ocean's 8, Sicario 2, Hotel Transylvania 3, Summer Vacation, Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again, and Slender Man. Those are titles.
So we won't know if John Trucker's lineup is going to pay off till Incredibles 2. That's when we'll start to get a good idea. And then basically it's when Mission Impossible comes out near the end that they would consolidate their lead if it's going to work out that way. If Chips Bitch strategy pays off, I don't know when we know. Is it Hotel Transylvania, Mamma Mia, or is it all the way to Slender Man? I have no idea.
Well, to hear him talk about Slender Man, you would think Cargill, and of course he's a little plugged in with what Hollywood is thinking. He seems to feel like there's a lot of potential with that one.
Yeah. And Hotel Transylvania, it was probably sold for a little less than it should have been. So.
Oh yeah. No. That was a steal. He did great. Yep. He got that for 18. That's going to be probably $120 to $160 million.
Well, congratulations on being in first place with your $28 million opening of Pacific Rim.
I'm going to enjoy every second of it while it lasts.
Let's talk about Atlanta season one. I watched it in two parts. We watched like the first three last fall, and then we finally finished it up this past weekend. We were going to watch a movie, and then Eileen's like, well, let's watch in Atlanta. And then it became, at the end of each episode, let's watch one more Atlanta. Should we watch one more? We actually watched the first episode of season two, and then if it was finally late enough that we went to sleep. But what I loved about it is those first three episodes we watched in the fall were funny. It was good. I enjoyed it. But I felt like I was watching a slightly funny drama because they were setting up the character. The middle episodes go in an entirely different direction. They focus on different characters. They make Glover's character a background character for these stories. And I started to absolutely adore it because it was, hey, this is a meditation on sports with the basketball episode. This is a meditation on sort of sibling-like friend relationships with the episode that starts in the restaurant and the woman that's like, hey, you should smoke some pot with me. And then it turns out she has a drug test the next day, which was an episode on drug testing and the hypocrisies involved in that as well. And then, of course, there's the commercials episode, which threw us off because we pay for Hulu without commercials. We had never had a commercial, and then it opened with a Dodge commercial.
Oh, like, did that just make you irrationally angry?
Well, that was weird. And then I'm like, but who was that in the Dodge? Like, that's interesting. And then, of course, we started to get it, which is beautiful. Like, that's the way it should work. It should have unsettled us like that. And obviously, you have your favorite commercial or your favorite moment in that episode.
One of the things I respect the most about Atlanta is that it simultaneously is so grounded and yet also so insane, just so off the rails, not remotely plausible. And that moment in, I want to say it's like episode 6 of the first season, where it's like they spend the entire episode building up the idea that one of the characters believes somebody has an invisible car, and they're like, no,
it's very obviously like staged Instagram, like, oh, that's funny, he's pretending there's an invisible car there, right?
And then they just cut to somebody driving an invisible car just for a less than 1 second gag.
Yeah, like
it was
knocking
amazing.
People down.
Yes. No, it's great. I love the balls on the show. I love the fact that that nothing about what you've seen before will ever prepare you for what you're about to see next. I think it's brilliant and really well done.
Yeah, I really liked the cereal commercial in that episode, which takes place mostly in the club. And it's like you say, I think you summed it up. The show is grounded until it's not, and then it's hilarious. I don't know what else to say about Atlanta except well done. And apparently season two, which is like four or five episodes in, is very different than season one. That wasn't preeminently evident to me in the first episode, but I'm still curious to see what he's got to throw at us.
Yeah, right on.
Let's talk about Isle of Dogs. So on my, fine, great, good, amazing, mind-blowing scale, I'm coming away with good on this one. And I'm a dog owner, dog lover. I am a Wes Anderson fan. I like a lot of his movies. I don't have any specific thing that I didn't like about the way he dealt with dogs. It didn't bother me that he showed dogs in painful situations. And as we mentioned earlier before the show, sometimes making you think they're dead when they're not. I found that realistic. I just didn't get carried away by the story the way I wish I would have.
Yeah, it was interesting because this was his second stop motion animated feature, which meant that I couldn't help but view everything through the lens of how did this compare to the Fantastic Mr. Fox. And Fantastic Mr. Fox is, I think, superior on all accounts. It was more charming, more engrossing. It had a story that I knew what I was supposed to feel, and I felt it the entire way through. Whereas Isle of Dogs, he made some bold choices, which I respect. And as an adult watching it, I really enjoyed the quirkiness of the decision of, well, and now's the part where somebody needs a kidney. So obviously what we're going to do is a protracted 90-second shot where we're going to graphically show the cutting open of one person, the transplanting of an organ into another person. And we're never going to cut away.
Stop motion.
Yes, yeah. Yes, yes. Which, very weird, right? But then on top of that, like, it's, you know, you got the main MacGuffin, the character they're trying to find. They're all like, oh, him? No. They were never able to open his crate. He died. And then you just spend a whole bunch of time looking at bones thinking that's him. And then they're like, oh, psych. No, it's him. It's, you know, he's fine. But then meanwhile, like, I'm hearing my daughter, as did the entire theater, hear her say, like, but some other dog died. Like, it doesn't soften the blow.
Yeah.
And then
that was actually, like, early on in the movie when, you know, the premise is the dogs are all going to be exiled to Trash Island by an anti-dog family. And I was like, okay, the dogs better freaking prevail, right? You've set up, as a dog lover, you've set up a premise where the dogs pretty much have to almost kill, if not kill, the bad guys for this to be okay. Because they show the cage being taken over on the pulley to the island. And I'm like, that kennel's locked. That dog can't get out of there. As someone who every time I have ever put a dog in a kennel thinks, oh my goodness, I hope there's not a fire while I'm gone. You know, because I will never forgive myself. I was like, is there a key? How's he getting out? Like, I was immediately thinking, how is he going to get out? And that was bothering me this entire time until they find the bones. And then I was angry because I'm like, oh, so basically it was torture and kill a dog. This is not fun. It may be real, but it's not fun. And then of course the other penny drops later, like it wasn't Spot. And then I'm like, well, wait a minute. Then how did the other dog get in there? And why did the other dog get stuck in there? And I got all kinds of questions about that. But all right, I'm just going to have to let that go. And I think maybe it was too real in some respects when I wanted charming.
I can totally buy that. Everything about this setup looked like it was going to scream whimsy. And there was precious little whimsy, yes, in this movie. And by the way, first clue that maybe there's not as much whimsy as I'd like is the trailer for a rated R movie, Deadpool 2, that ran before Isle of Dogs that my kids were watching. Like, that was a bit odd. That's a choice.
I mean, it is Wes Anderson. I knew I wasn't in for a, you know, lighthearted.
The last stop motion animated Wes Anderson movie?
Well, all right, fair enough. But. I was prepared for that. I was like, okay, it's going to be serious. It was just, I don't know, maybe too dirty. Not dirty as in, like, you know, bad language dirty, but like, gritty, like filthy, gritty. Like,
yeah,
with flies and stuff.
Yeah. You felt a little bit dirty during it. I know that I loved those twists and turns. I could very much tell that my wife did not enjoy any of them because she was concerned about how all of this played to our children. And, you know, some of the kids were fine with it, like, whatever, it's dogs animated or whatever. But the 14-year-old who really grokked, you know, misery and pain and abandonment and the fingers of a trash island She was not having a good time at all. However, I do, again, want to just high five some of the artistic choices, not the least of which is, you know, having a disclaimer at the beginning saying, hey, we're going to translate the parts we feel like translating it, and we're going to translate it in whatever way we feel like. So sometimes you're going to know what they're saying, sometimes not. Peace out, Wes Anderson.
Yeah, Eileen was asked, my wife was asking me afterwards, she's like, how did you feel about the way they treated Japanese culture? Because there was an article she was reading by a person of Japanese descent saying he felt like Wes Anderson was inaccurately appropriating Japanese culture because it was, you know, the big strong man and everything. And I'm like, you know, I get that. And as someone who's not Japanese, I can't say that's wrong. Like, maybe that rubs you the wrong way if you're Japanese, and I totally respect that. I did like his choice to cast Japanese actors in those parts. He had a Japanese co-writer on the story. And like you said, I think the piece de resistance was like, hey, when they're speaking Japanese, they speak Japanese, and that's it. We're only subtitling things if it's not a language that they don't speak, right? The dogs get translated into English, basically. That's it.
Yeah, what little I read, because I read the beginning of that article, and I was like, well, I don't want to go into this movie with this baggage in my head, so I didn't read the rest of it. So I do owe whoever wrote that article the rest of a reading, but I did immediately bristle at what felt like an unfair accusation of, you know, like for the crime of being a white man doing a movie that's set in a fictionalized future Japan. You know, he has to, I don't know, get raked over.
I mean,
coals.
There are lines that can be crossed on those things.
Sure, like, sure. But I didn't see any of those in the movie.
Whether Wes crossed them or not, as a person who isn't Japanese, I don't think so. But then I might not, because I might not be attuned to it. So,
yes. I'm going to need a little more evidence than I saw watching the movie, because I got as far as seeing like, OK, there's an accusation. I'll look for that when I see the movie. Watching the movie, I thought it was highly respectful. I thought it was charming. I thought it was enchanting. And there's a lot that I liked about it.
My wife is also not Japanese, but she's Filipino. So she has some, you know, Asian sensibilities that she's quick to defend. She didn't think it was necessarily egregious in that respect. But again, she's like, I'm also not Japanese either. So I don't know. What she did say afterwards, she's like, that was pretty good. It was a little hard at times, but the cats lost.
I loved some of those Wes Anderson touches that, for example, in the opening, you have the stark spotlight and you have the drummers drumming and the camera spins around the drummers in a highly dramatic way. And to no benefit, with no justification, back in the background, in the shadows, you can see a basketball hoop that indicates that this is being shot, quote unquote, in a high school gymnasium. I loved all of those little touches where he makes it real and tangible in a way, you know, that there was no reason for him to needed to have done, but it did make it better.
Yeah. I'd probably regret this wish if it was fulfilled, but I'm going to say it anyway. I almost wished while I was watching it that there were more dog moments. There were a few where they did a dog thing instead of what the people would do. But I kind of expected more of that. And it really did feel like, well, yeah, they're dogs, but they're really Ed Norton and Bill Murray and Bryan Cranston.
Yeah. I don't know. I thought there was plenty of those moments. You know what? Yeah, I wish I could put my finger on it. There was something just a little bit off, a little bit missing from it that didn't.
And I feel like I have to make the normal brushwood disclaimer of I didn't dislike the movie. I thought it was good.
Sure.
I enjoyed it. But I'm trying to, like you say, put my finger on what it was that bugged me about it that kept it from being amazing, because I feel like I should have. If Wes Anderson dogs handled right, I don't know. Should have rocked my world.
Yeah. And that's, of course, it's an unfair expectation. But watching the movie did solve the strange gap from it having like a 93% positive Rotten Tomatoes and yet an IMDb aggregate score of like 7.5 or something, which I thought was interesting, which I think was accurate, because I understand why in general everybody would say, yeah, it's good. It's good. but just not near. I wouldn't even put it in the top five of Wes Anderson movies.
Yeah, probably not. I probably wouldn't either. All right, let us move on to Deadwood, episode 2 of season 2, A Lie Agreed Upon, part 2, where Bullock gets his weapon back.
Tom, remember when I didn't like the last episode and I thought it was boring and slow and nothing happened and I thought this is pretty much the worst episode of Deadwood? How about part 2 of the worst episode of Deadwood, in which even less happens, and it, what does happen happens even more slowly, and the only good part was when Calamity Jane said, yeah, that's right, I farted. That was the only part of joy that I found.
Yeah, if you thought part 1 was slow, this is not going to help. This part 2 did not pick up the pace in any way. It got even more navel-gazing.
So meandering, so nonsensical, so Swearingen acting unswearingen-y, and I hated it. Tom, I hated this episode. I hated it.
All right.
I was looking at my watch saying, how much longer do I have to sit through this? It was awful.
When are the Hoopleheads going to finish this episode, thought Brian.
I did. And I'm sorry. It's just to give me literally like when it cut to setting up the other horror house, I'm like, oh, finally something's going to happen. These girls, we're going to see a montage. They're going to make this a no. They're just wandering around an empty ass room.
Let's talk about the things that, while not much happened, I'm not going to dispute that. The events that progressed here were Bullock got his gun back, and it looks like he and Swearingen are pals now.
Let's take that moment for starters, because sure, that should make me feel better. Like there was some resolution, but
right. And I actually liked the moment where Swearingen makes the calculation of, okay, I'm just going to play this to my own advantage and let him get his weapon back, because I don't see the benefit in bringing him down. I didn't like that it was because he theoretically might be in the pocket of the governor of Montana. That felt like it was a little deus ex machina for my taste.
Well, and especially since he spent the whole first season under the erroneous delusion that he was some master player to a bigger game other than what he appeared to be. And then now he just falls right back into that trap. That's not only not interesting, that's not Swearingen-y. You know, Swearingen's a smart guy who understands that stuff. I guess the trials and tribulations of how much he did or didn't pee continued. That's some high drama for us. I did like the brief amount of tender chemistry, and I don't necessarily mean sexual chemistry. I just mean affectionate chemistry between Jane and the doc.
Yeah.
Although still have no idea why she shows up announcing that she's dying, like with no evidence or cause or no journey of why she would think that.
Have you ever known that person? Because I have.
Sure,
that
sure.
Person who just kind of comes out of nowhere. They're always kind of needy, often a drunk, and they're just like, I'm dying. And you're like, no, you're not, but okay. Like, I don't know. That felt like the thing that played the most true to me, because it was like, oh, of course Jane is going to be that person. She's going to say that kind of thing.
Sure. But I think the thing that bummed me out the most, and maybe I wouldn't feel this way if we watched parts 1 and part 2 straight through. If I watched it as a 2-hour movie, then it would have been just one big boring Band-Aid and I could have just ripped it right off. But I think splitting it into 2 just really made that second part, that funeral dirge just kept on going for is slow.
I kind of like where we end with Swearingen back okay with Bullock, but there's a little uneasy history now, right? With Swearingen not liking Bullock because he ran a hardware store was always a little bit like, well, why not? I mean, just get over it. Swearingen having something against Bullock because they had this fight, okay. That's something that might crop up again and make sense to me. I like that Bullock ends up being forced to go back to his brother's wife and try to figure that out. You know, the idea of him sneaking off with Alma, I knew it wasn't going to happen because they're, you know, Timothy Oliphant's not going to leave the show. But it also felt like that was the easy way out for him. And it's more interesting to see him have to make this work with Walter White's wife.
Yeah. What else is there? Psy continues to get less and less interesting.
Psy didn't even do much. What he did was not interesting. You're right.
He turned into a cartoon. Who was the most nuanced, interesting, villainous character in the show suddenly.
Oh, I did like, what's his, George? Is that his name? Wild Bill's friend, Jane's friend.
Charlie Utter.
Charlie. I did like Charlie sort of figuring out how to stop Bullock from just charging over to Swearingen's. I thought that was nicely done.
Yeah, masterful acting job by one Charlie Utter. Oh, I am become faint, good sir. Will you take me to my place?
Even if it's a bad acting job, what's Bullock going to do? Be like, nah, screw you. I'm going to go get my gun. It's like,
yeah,
like,
and I guess also because they already have him baked out of his mind. You know, Saul didn't do much of anything interesting outside of explore. You know, cursing out loud. And it's like, I don't know. I would have rather watched an hour of just whatever Jewel was doing this entire time.
It was an utter failure for you?
No.
Calamity?
It was not. Don't you. It's not justified. Stop.
Would you say it's bollocks?
No, okay. All right. So Deadwood, maybe episode 3 will be better and get me back on track.
I don't mean to spoil it, but a geologist is coming to town.
Oh. What? Okay.
Is that a euphemism?
No, an actual geologist is in the next episode, apparently.
Oh.
According to the non-spoilery description, a geologist comes to town.
It's Stephen Hawking, isn't it?
I have come to check your rocks. Ah, the late, great Stephen Hawking. It's very sad to say that. Okay, thanks everybody for watching or listening to Spoiler in Time. We would like to break these episodes up and make them even easier for you to go back and catch up on the shows that you haven't watched with us, like time travel. And if you would like to be part of that solution, join our Patreon or even increase your current Patreon at patreon.com/cordkillers. We will spoil you again next week.
Yeah.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.